Does listening to reading Dharma teachings affect the content of thoughts? If so, how? Is it an active or passive process? I'm asking because sometimes I find one self actively trying to convince another self about a Dharma teaching. Yes, impermanence is true. See the flower wilting. This means the situation you don't like will change too. But maybe just letting it passively seep in is a better approach. So would you like to respond to that, Pam?
I'll do my best. I want to start with a piece that I just want to name. It may be obvious, but Andrea was speaking to the kind of, how might we say, the tenacity of these, what we're calling beliefs, that fuel our delusion. And I just want to say out loud, and I think it's connected to the question in a roundabout way, that a belief is not just a thought. That a belief is, it's more like a whole web. And to go back to this emphasis on, you know, seeing a belief may not be enough for it to dissolve. But in the language we've been using, feeling the impact of the belief. So it's a way of saying our beliefs are rooted in our flesh. Our beliefs have a kind of tenacity because they actually shape how we are, how we perceive, and so on. So it's not, I'm saying this by way of suggesting that you not be disappointed if you see some of your delusion and then it doesn't just vanish automatically. It may take 10 times or 20 times or 100 times. And each time there's kind of a, it's like loosening up of the ways in which that belief has its tentacles, if you will, in our heart, in our mind, in our body. So it's not a, sometimes a belief will pop, poof, and it's gone. But often that's not how it works. So in the same way, I would say everything conditions us. So does listening to a Dharma talk condition the mind? Well, yes. But so does, you know, checking your email 20 times a day. And so does watching TV, and so does all of the things that you've done up until this moment. So this is really a central point in understanding that what's here, what's arising, how we experience any moment is, as Andrea has been saying, it's conditioned. And so part of what makes these beliefs so sticky and tenacious is that there are many things that have gone into that conditioning. So we may see one part of it, but we may not have seen the whole thing. So is it an active practice or a passive practice? I think that was in the framing of the question. And, you know, the answer is yes. There's a way, there's a formulation in Buddhist teaching that talks about the deepening of wisdom that happens in three steps. And the first is hearing. So we may hear a Dharma talk. And the second part of deepening of wisdom comes from reflecting. Reflecting really means something like Andrea was saying earlier, like, okay, I heard all these teachings. Now I'm going to check it against my own experience. Like, is it true? Are greed and aversion suffering? Let me find out for myself. So we're going to reflect on that making it personal in a way. And the last part of the real deepening of wisdom, which is often said where the real transformative impact can happen, is, it's more of a, excuse me for using a giant word here, but it's a sort of phenomenological process. And from the perspective of meditation, what that means is that we actually are present enough to see how it's happening, how the whole thing works in a moment. So we may be able to see, for example, that there's an unpleasant sound. And then we say, oh, not liking. And then we see tension or gripping in the jaw. And then we notice agitation. So we're actually seeing how the whole process unfolds. Mostly, we're not present enough to do that. We just notice, 5 minutes or 5 hours later that we have a headache. Like, damn, I have a headache. But when we're practicing in this way, with this kind of intimacy with our experience, we can actually see how a moment of experience unfolds, how it is that suffering arises. And if we can see how suffering arises, we can begin to see, as Andrea was pointing to, not just the presence, but also the absence. We can see how it can unarise. We can start to notice what it feels like when it's not there. And we can start to notice what are the conditions for suffering being absent, being not present. So that's probably, I hope that's enough to speak to that piece. Looks like there's another question.
Yeah, do you want to read that one and take that one too?
Sure. I haven't read it yet. Doesn't aversion sometimes serve a purpose? For example, if you are in an unhealthy relationship and need to separate from the person. So that's our belief often, that we think we need this grasping and pushing away in order to engage. Andrea was talking about this yesterday around, engagement in the world. We think that we need to be angry in order to engage. Now, it could be that anger could give us energy and support our engagement, but it's not true that we need it. In other words, separating from a person can come from wisdom. Now, it may be that part of that wisdom includes feeling angry. Because if we've been repressing, like Andrea was talking about depression, which is sometimes described as when there's anger that's repressed, it comes out as depression. So it may mean that there's it will be different for different ones of us, that there's anger that is useful to be felt. But useful in feeling it is different than useful in acting on it. And one of our big beliefs is that, if I'm not angry, I'm not going to engage. So I want to be clear, I'm not saying that anger is bad. I don't think that's true, actually. It's unpleasant often. But I am saying that anger is not the only place, to the point of this question, that a separation from, say, an unhealthy relationship can come from. It could come from absolute clarity at some point when we've felt whatever it is, our sadness, our anger, our disappointment, all the various things, all of that is felt all the way through. And then at a certain point, there can be just pristine kind of clarity, like, okay, and now the decision is clear. I found that for myself often, that if I really stay with my own process, that often it's not really me making a decision to do something, but that it becomes clear what the decision is. The decision makes me. And I will say that I've had many experiences where I'm not happy about that. Like it becomes clear that I need to leave, or I need to stay, or I need to change something. And I feel like, damn. So that's how I know it's not my habitual conditioning that's making the decision. It's having been fully present with the circumstances enough so that the clarity itself arises. Do you have anything to add? You want to add to that?
I thought one piece that, you know, sometimes we might, in practicing in, you know, Buddhist meditation and learning about these perspectives on greed and aversion, we might feel like, you know, we're not supposed to feel anger, or we're not supposed to feel greed. And it's like, well, as this sutta says, you know, when greed is arising in the mind, you know that it's arising in the mind. When aversion is arising in the mind, you know that it's arising in the mind. When anger is arising in the mind around a partnership, a relationship where there's, you know, unskillful action and you need to separate, you know that that's arising in the mind. So that it's not about like not experiencing it or pushing it away, but understanding it. You know, when there is anger like that, you know, it's conditioned, and it is, you know, it can be. And Gil one time said, you know, as a reflection on anger, I remember he said, when anger is arising, somebody is suffering. And it's probably you. So that's worth knowing. And there are times too when, you know, the ideal would be perhaps that you could potentially connect with the wisdom that's under there and act from the wisdom rather than lashing out of the anger. But we can't always do that either. You know, sometimes I use this example, you know, if you're walking down the street with the child and the child's like, you know, pulling at your hand and then like runs into the street chasing a dog and you see a car coming, you don't just sit there going, oh, fear is arising. You know, you act, you pull the child out of the road, even if there's fear there. You know, so there are times where we do have to act when these challenging and reactive emotions are present. And there may be some ramifications of that. Like, you know, there could be, you know, if there's yelling and screaming in a relationship, when there's anger, you know, that may come back at you with yelling and screaming on the other side. So, you know, so there's going to be consequences to acting from anger. But sometimes we can't wait to act. We can't hold ourselves up to some standard and say, well, there's anger arising, so I shouldn't act. You know, that maybe it is appropriate to act. What I sometimes say too is like, maybe you can recognize or know that there is some compassion in there too for wanting to alleviate the suffering. You know, the anger arises in dependence on the situation and the harm perhaps that's being caused. There can be compassion in there to want to alleviate the suffering either for yourself, for the other person, for both, mixed in with the anger. You know, they can be mixed up. And maybe you can know that there is some compassion in there along with the anger, and kind of, you know, maybe recognize or be a little bit like landing on the side of the compassion in the action. But, you know, it's a whole process. There's if we had to wait to act until greed, aversion, and delusion were gone, we would be hamstrung.
I just want to say, I think it's important that we're not saying that anger in this case, or greed or delusion even, they're not bad. It's really important. We're not saying that at all. What I was trying to say is that it's also not true that anger is necessary, yes, in order to act. That's all. But as Andrea is saying, sometimes we get angry. And sometimes that anger is necessary. I had an encounter this morning in Golden Gate Park when I was walking my dog with a coyote. And I was screaming very loudly at the top of my lungs, ah, like that, to try to get the coyote to go away. And the coyote was quite persistent. I had to scream 3 times because it backed off and then it followed us again and I had to do it again. This was not a pleasant experience, right? But to Andrea's point, it was that I had the great experience of somebody was walking by and he very kindly said to me, "You did exactly the right thing." Because normally when we're screaming and yelling, we think, oh, this can't be any good, right? But sometimes that's actually what's needed. And of course, to Andrea's point, there was enormous amount of compassion in that. I didn't want this coyote to eat my little dog, right? So often there's multiple things going on that we have to see. But the whole point is that we're allowing ourselves to have what's here. This is the essence, I think, of delusion, is thinking things that thinking that things should be other than they are. That's kind of the seed, right? So when you find yourself in a state, pleasant, unpleasant, intense, subtle, whatever it is, and you notice that there's this layer of, this is not okay, shouldn't be this way, that's delusion. Why? Because it is this way. And we're not trying to manipulate our experience, we're trying to understand it. How can we understand it if we're doing this to it, if we're judging it, keeping our distance, or pretending it away? That's not going to get us very far. That's why this heartfulness is so important, because we have to learn to have the grit. Someone used the other day the word courage, to really be with all of it. So I know we're at time.
Yeah. So thank you all. Carry on.
Enjoy your delusion. Explore your delusion, maybe. Yeah. Thanks, everybody.